This podcast is brought to you by ClearBridge Investments. Meet an evolving economy confidently with ClearBridge Active Equities, the foundation of a resilient portfolio. ClearBridge, a Franklin Templeton company. Go to clearbridge.com to learn more.
Please stay tuned for important disclosure information at the conclusion of this episode.
Hi, and welcome to The Long View. I'm Christine Benz, Director of Personal Finance for Morningstar.
And I'm Jeff Patak, Global Director of Manager Research for Morningstar Research Services.
Our guest this week is Cheryl Garrett. Cheryl is founder of the Garrett Planning Network, a national network of hourly, fee-only financial planners that she started in 2000. Cheryl has authored, co-authored, or served as technical editor on many books, including Garrett's Guide to Financial Planning, Just Give Me the Answers, and Personal Finance Workbook for Dummies. She has worked with the House Subcommittee on Financial Services regarding predatory lending regulation, financial literacy, and Social Security reform. She has also received numerous awards in financial planning during her career. Most recently, Investment News named Cheryl as its 2019 Investment News icon. Cheryl, welcome to The Long View.
Oh, thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here.
Cheryl, let's start with your evolution into the network, which focuses on providing hourly, fee-only advice. It started from your work as a wealth manager, where you found that you had a number of clients that you were having to turn away because they didn't fit with that business model. So let's talk about how you hit on the hourly model and being fee-only.
Absolutely. The firm that I was with in the wealth management was a fee-only firm, but you know, a lot of people that called didn't meet our minimum. At the time, it was $4,000 a year. And I just started noticing that it was bothering me personally, that I couldn't provide assistance to these people. So I decided it was time. I had enough confidence in working with the end user client. I felt the need and demand. And I also asked myself one really important question. How would I want to receive advice if I were a consumer of financial advice? I've always been kind of a do-it-yourselfer in a lot of areas. I don't tend to want to hand everything over to somebody else to do it. And so I built a financial planning practice and a financial advisory firm the way I would want to receive advice. And that would be go in, share what you have going on and what your questions are and provide the information and somebody provides me my guidance or answers. And that's exactly what I did. And the amazing thing was the public liked it. You know, I went based on my gut instinct of what I would want. And delightfully, the public liked it. I told my former partner, she told her former partner, and we also shared it with another financial advisor in the Kansas City area. And those three fee-only financial advisors provided me three quarters of my new business because for the most part, the people that were inquiring with them fell underneath their minimum. So I didn't impose a minimum. So I was a very easy referral to make. Within less than 2 years, I was receiving as many calls from financial advisors as I was prospective clients saying, I like what I'm hearing about what you're doing. How can I do it? And a year later, well, a little over two years after starting my hourly practice, we launched the Garrett Planning Network to help other financial advisors do exactly what I was doing. And that was working with, you know, anyone, whether it be a beginner, a do-it-yourselfer, or a validator type individual who wanted or needed financial advice on their terms. And so we launched the Garrett Planning Network in July of 2000.
So how did you hit on the hourly model versus, say, a flat fee model?
That's a great question. How I hit on it was, it wasn't like an aha moment. It was at a time, you know, I started offering this over 20 years ago in 1998, to be precise. So 21 years ago, I opened my hourly shop and I actually knew of a handful of other hourly advisors at the time, but nobody else necessarily knew about them. So it was extremely uncommon. But when I really looked at how would I want advice, I want to pay just for what I need. You know, and I see that, to me, I look at that as that's capitalism in the truest sense, is if you just need this, then that's what I should buy. And if I need a whole lot more, I should pay more. And so I always had a difficulty, or a philosophical difficulty, I should say, with charging assets under management some percentage or a fraction of a percentage of the money that I might manage for somebody. Because to me, that didn't tend to represent the amount of work involved, some formula. And so instead of trying to make a formula fit the situation, I thought, you know, doesn't it really boil down to the time that a professional has to put in to the work? You know, presuming they know what they're doing and they do the job, you pay their time. Like an attorney or architect to design a home for you. And it might be quoted as a flat fee based on the expectation of time. But to me, that was the cleanest, fairest, most simple way to charge for my work. And I found that the industry thought I was a nut and that it would not be well received by the public. But the public proved otherwise. And the feedback that I got from them was more aligned. One client said, we went looking for financial advisors and talked to several people. And until we found you, we didn't realize that it was so rare to pay someone just for what you need them to do for you. I was like, you know, that seemed broken. And so I actually pontificated or prognosticated, about 20 years ago that this would be, you know, charging for time by the hour would be the most common way financial advice is sold and provided in the future. And my guesstimate was about 20 years into the future. I think we may have another 10 or 20 years to go before it becomes the most common way that advice is rendered. But I am seeing more and more people basing their charge for services and the time rendered working on in behalf of a client and with a client is based on the time they put into it rather than how much money am I managing for the client, how tall or wide or, you know, how big is their portfolio. I just think that's, you know, these are goofy ways of coming up with a fee. So the amount of time I put into a project times an hourly rate is how a lot of professionals have been providing their services for years. So that's what I felt was appropriate for me. And that's how I employ my lawyers. I definitely don't want a lawyer on retainer. I don't want to have to need a lawyer on retainer. But I do need a lawyer periodically to review a contract or, you know, when working on a bit of adoption work that we needed to take care of, or maybe my tree fell on the neighbor's fence. And I do need to turn to a professional for advice, and I want to pay them just for what I need. And that's it. Nothing more.
Many AUM-based advisors say that their clients hate writing checks for their services. So how do you get clients over that kind of mental accounting where it's okay if that fee comes out of their portfolio, but if we're talking about my checking account, now we're talking real money. How uh-huh. have you helped to get, I guess, maybe clients over that?
Good point, Jeff. And it is true, you know. It is the pain of paying. You do absolutely have to write a check or pay for the services. But I actually think there's, for the most part, this isn't a completely generalized statement, but for the most part, the issue is bigger between the financial advisor's ears than it is between the client's ears about paying. Most of, I'm sure, your listeners and people that utilize Morningstar's products and services are more savvy individuals, and they know they're paying. It's just, how am I paying? And am I paying the right amount? It's less painful to pull the money out of the account. You know, it's kind of like using a credit card. Would I rather part with cash or would I rather swipe a credit card? Both of them involve paying the exact same amount of money until the interest kicks in on the credit card if you don't pay it off. But there is more pain in paying with cash. We as humans typically don't part with our cash as easily as we'll swipe a card. Same kind of concept when it comes to paying for advice. But folks, if you think you're getting your advice for free, you're not. You're usually paying way more if you think you're getting it for free, because the advisor, or finger quote advisor, is getting paid guaranteed. And you may be paying far more than you needed to because you're not working with a fiduciary who's obligated to put your best interests first and has a duty of loyalty and due care for the services they provide. So I think we just have to grow through it. And I think it is something that I tell people, that members of the Garrett Planning Network, that if our clients don't recognize they're paying for our services and we earn those fees and they come back again and again, if we didn't earn those fees, people wouldn't keep coming back. And so our clients know exactly what they're paying. They know exactly what we earn and they feel good about it. Because, I mean, they may not wish to spend excess money, but they feel good because they know that 100% of what we earn came from them. We're not getting a kickback from recommending something that might not be in their best interest. We're not taking over control of their portfolio and having to manage that. We work with a lot of do-it-yourselfers. And I think probably the majority of people that listen to this podcast manage their own portfolio. I would be shocked if that's not the case. And at the same time, I've worked with a lot of do-it-yourselfers who manage their own portfolio that appreciated coming in and kind of having a second opinion with me. One client called it that, and it made a lot of sense. As he was doing the portfolio decision making, but he said, you know, tell me what you think. And I told him what I thought. And he was doing a really good job, but it wasn't as tax efficient as it could have been. There were a lot of really good positions, but it was really sprawled out. And so it could have been much more streamlined and more tax efficient, but it didn't take a whole long time to make those changes. So I reviewed the entire portfolio, wrote up the changes that I'd like to see the client do, and the client implemented that. I saved my time for my highest and greatest good of evaluating and providing advice that was in the client's best interest. And then the client did what they do quite well. That's execute the trades and make the things happen, because that's what he'd been doing all along. So we worked quite well together. But he didn't, that couple did not hire my previous wealth management firm the two times they came in to talk us into working with them, because we required them to turn over control. And I, as a financial advisor, when I was looking at designing my new practice, that was what I chose not to do. I was not going to manage portfolios on a continual and ongoing basis, because I'm a financial planner first and foremost. We're not individual daily money managers. So when you need that kind of service, pay for it. And when you don't, you know, we got to be frugal about things. But yeah, it's a real situation. What I encourage people to think about is, when you hear a quote for a fee, convert it to dollars and then carry it out, say, 5 years. And you'll be shocked to see how much money you're spending, regardless of the compensation structure of the advisor, whether they're charging a commission, an assets under management, a flat fee that stays level all 5 years, or an hourly fee that I would have charged when I was working with individual clients, and many of our members in the network do, is, you know, maybe that first time we get together, we have a bigger project, or maybe we have a really urgent project that needs to be taken care of, but it's small. We deal with that first. And then we might do a bigger project that's more holistic, but it's not as urgent. And we do that when it's more convenient for the client. And then maybe there's another step that we need to do, and we take care of that, kind of focusing more on Stephen Covey's rules of, you know, focus on the urgent and critical first, and not really, you know, need to sell a comprehensive financial plan and money management included to every single person walking the earth. I think that's overkill. And I don't necessarily think that it's fulfilling our fiduciary obligation to the client. In fact, when we oversell ourselves, that's not being a fiduciary.
One thing I sometimes wonder, Cheryl, is whether client needs for advice kind of change over the life cycle. So it seems to me that the real attraction to having the hands-on asset manager would be later in life when we know cognitive decline can be an issue, where someone may not have the ability to do hands-on record management and so forth. So is that your view as well, that maybe someone could use a Garrett hourly advisor while they're comfortable and capable of managing some aspects of their finances, but then perhaps hand it off later in life?
Very likely, yes. And or that same advisor that they were working with on an hourly basis, a fee-only payment structure can be an assets under management structure. I am pro-fiduciary, pro-fee only, and pro-hourly. But we have members within our group that I don't prohibit people from offering a retainer or an assets under management arrangement. I just personally didn't offer that. But I think you raised a really important point, Christine, is that, you know, when you're first starting out in life, sitting down for an hour or two or three with an hourly advisor could be the best investment you could make. You know, just don't make any dumb mistakes and get started outright. And then there may be a time in life, and I actually had a couple of clients that I referred to a full-time ongoing money manager to manage their portfolios. And I continued to work with the couples as their financial planner, but we outsourced the money management. All financial planners don't need to also be the best money manager, or are they? You know, I see financial planning as a job, and I see ongoing investment advice as a different job. A lot of financial planners do both. If they have a firm that has the bench strength and the talent to be able to deliver that, great. But if you're talking about a solo advisor or a very small firm, do they have the bench strength to be able to serve all of their clients in the best way? So because I like to be a small firm, you know, there were four of us at a peak, you know, or maybe five. I really enjoyed focusing on the financial planning aspects and, you know, all parts of life that, you know, money affects, and have someone who watches the investment portfolio on a continual and ongoing basis do so. And there have been more and more options available to us in more recent years. 15 or so years ago, I was introduced to Rick Ferry and his firm at the time, and the fee to outsource those services, 25 basis points. How can I, as a fiduciary, even compete with that, even if I was as good as his team of CFAs and traders and portfolio managers and all their years of experience? I don't know that I could even do as well, and I know I couldn't do it as cost effectively. And so that's something the fiduciary should own and think of. But the climate, the environment of advice has changed very rapidly as well. And, you know, in the last 5 to 10 years, we've seen a number, still not gobs, you know, there's not a whole lot of them yet, but more, many more, outside parties such as Morningstar, Schwab, Fidelity. there are a number of discount brokers, a number of third-party managers, First Ascent out of Denver, a number of registered investment advisory companies or firms that their purpose is to provide outsource service either directly to the consumer or for advisors' clients. And so many of us that embrace an hourly financial planning role as our primary focus, we are proud and happy to outsource that ongoing management if and as needed to the appropriate parties. And we can still be a contact person and work in and amongst the money manager and, you know, kind of be the quarterback if the client desires that. But there's other times when we see that, you know, cognitive decline definitely would be an issue. I had clients that would come in just to make certain their spouse got to meet me and to make certain that their spouse would be knowing who to call and, you know, how to take things forward. So I think that it's very important for us to think about the times in which we do need this help. Another couple came, and they were a much younger couple. It wasn't a cognitive decline issue. This is something that actually in certain parts of the country I hear about constantly, well, maybe not constantly, but quite frequently, is that people have a transition that they come into a lot of money for some reason. For instance, I was thinking of the high-tech industry and stock options. And we need to decide, do we exercise? If we exercise, what do we do? Do we sell? How do we reinvest the proceeds in something like that? And so that might be a really great time where you would want somebody who's in there on a continual ongoing basis working with you through that stage of life. And then you could switch back to an as-needed kind of service, you know, just paying as you go. All can be done on an hourly basis, paying for time, but I would definitely measure the anticipated hours and the outsourcing percentage fee that you might be looking at. You know, many of the providers that we're hearing from today are somewhere in the 25 to 40 basis points, or 0.25 to 0.40. And that's substantially lower than what we typically see for a lot of financial advisors, financial planners. Many offer their services, say, for 1%. And we'll also include financial planning. And our minimum is you have to have $1 million. So they will earn $10,000 a year off your portfolio at 1%. If you went to an hourly advisor, what would the total charges be? And what if they outsourced the portfolio management? Or what if they did that part for you on a monthly or quarterly basis instead of an ongoing daily basis? Do we change or need to babysit all of our assets or portfolio daily? Can we make changes that improve things? I argue probably not. In fact, the more we babysit it, the more harm we could do. We want to find the right allocation, buy good solid investments, and, you know, keep an eye on them, but don't overreact. I don't see a lot of activity going on in a portfolio typically. And so I find it kind of hard to justify paying for continual and ongoing portfolio supervision. But when you do have cognitive impairment, you do have a person or a couple that they're busy professionals, they don't want to deal with this kind of stuff, and they have the financial wherewithal or need to have someone take care of that, that is great. There are a lot of options, actually, far more options for outsourcing all of that. You know, if you want to transfer all of your financial planning work and have a firm take care of that, or an individual at a firm take care of that, there's a lot more options for that than there are for people who will work on an as-needed basis.
Cheryl, one model that we've seen coming on strong recently with XY Planning Network and more recently Schwab is the subscription model. And I'm wondering if you can address that model relative to the hourly model. Is there a subset of folks for whom that model would actually make more sense than the hourly model?
Not to purposefully not answer the question you just asked, I'm going to reframe it just a little bit. I don't really see that much difference between paying a monthly fee and paying an hourly fee. For a lot of people, it's terminology that we're getting confused with. I actually had clients that paid their fee over a monthly basis. I didn't call it a subscription. So the concept for many of our advisors, and we do have advisors who charge their fee for a set amount of work to be covered over a period of time. So let's say it's over the next year, over the next 6 months, I'm going to do these things for you, and we're going to meet these times to take care of whatever it is that you've hired me to do. And the total cost is going to be X. There'll be a deposit, and then we'll divide the balance over the months. That's actually quite common. The concept of calling it a subscription, I think, is a bit marketing, and also a bit of just maybe reframing it so people think of it differently. It's not a retainer in the truest sense. A retainer would mean to me that somebody has the opportunity to say, hey, Cheryl, I've got, you know, something just happened. I need all of your attention right now. And my project and workload for this client just expanded massively, but their bill to me won't change because I am on retainer. Whereas if it were a monthly type of an agreement, there's only certain things that are going to happen. So this is more of a project that's been stretched out and paid for over time. So I just think it makes the payment more palatable and sometimes the homework and the work itself more palatable for the client to get the homework done, meet with the advisor, get the work implemented, or have the advisor maybe doing parts of it and the clients doing parts of it. So I just think it's another way to charge a time-based fee. It's still based on time, typically. It's an estimate, kind of like a flat fee, where we'd say, you know, to be able to provide these services that we discussed, I believe that that's going to cost $1,500. And so that might be my quote. I might turn that all around and get it done from start to finish in 6 weeks. Others might want to have a couple of meetings and we might get that done over 6 months. And so they might pay a deposit and then the balance of payments over that 6 month period of time. So for many people, it's a lot more palatable to pay the fee over 6 months versus a write a check for $1,500. Back to Jeff's point.
I wanted to ask you about a question more from the client's perspective. It seems that the hourly model, and we may have alluded to this in various points in our conversation, the hourly model does fundamentally shift the onus onto consumers to do a bit more of the heavy lifting for maintaining records and for keeping things running between visits. So are there clients or prospective clients who are just too busy or disorganized for that type of model to work well or to be cost effective for them?
I'm glad you added that last part, Jeff, about cost effective, because the way to make hourly work most cost effectively, in my viewpoint, is for the clients to participate. You know, financial advisors, for the most part, are unable to do all the implementation for our clients anyway. We don't go into the human resources office and reset their withholding. We can't contact HR and make changes. We can't, you know, refile their tax returns if there were errors or they missed a deduction. We don't draft estate planning documents and property and casualty insurance. There's tons of things that holistic financial planners do not implement for their clients. And so when I hear advisors say, well, but you guys don't implement, it's like, we only don't sell insurance and we only don't manage portfolios on a continual and ongoing basis. Perhaps. Some of us do. None of us sell insurance, but we do help clients implement if they want that help. And so it's really dependent. I attracted a lot of the do-it-yourselfers and validators because those are the people I most enjoyed working with. And I think that my messaging on my website and just the way I interacted with folks, and I found that I was, you know, very, very busy doing what I felt was the highest and greatest good that I could provide as an advisor, and that is to assess their situation and tell them what I would do in my professional opinion, and then empower them to make it happen. Filling out their name and address on a form is a very expensive use of my time and their money. And so if I can help them not feel uncomfortable or afraid to pull the trigger or, you know, make a decision on something. And I found in working with my clients, I actually didn't know this would happen until they proved it to me, that the clients just needed that assurance that, yes, this is what I want you to do. Okay, we got it covered. Because almost everyone that I worked with over the years, about 1,000 households as an hourly advisor, they had been managing their affairs with very minor exceptions, good, bad, or indifferently the whole time. A lot of us do. I find that that's where the majority of the population is. They need help. They might need a second opinion. They might need a checkup. They might need an expert to bounce ideas off of. You know, does this make sense to me? There hasn't really been any outlets for the public or people seeking advice to go and get that kind of second opinion. And I feel that it's extremely important for people to get that one-on-one direction. Even I met with one couple, lovely situation. And a prospective member of our group once said, what happens if you can't help somebody? And I said, what do you mean? And he said, well, what if you do a financial plan for somebody and find out that they're really in good shape? I said, how is that not helpful? I just validated that they are doing what they need to be doing. And I said, by the way, I have a recent story. And it was this couple that I was getting ready to mention. Couple comes in and meets with me. And just to make it quicker, I said, I have about 3 tweaks. Sir, you've been managing the family's household affairs, haven't you? And he said, yes. And he was, when we met the second time, he was very nervous. He was afraid what I had to say. His wife was so proud of him and patted him on the back, but he was nervous. And I said, sir, I wanted to break the ice at the beginning of the meeting instead of having him be nervous any longer. And I said that, sir, you've been taking care of this whole time, right? He said, yes. And his wife's like, yes, he's so great. He's so wonderful. He's done such a great job. And I said, yes, he has. I have 3 tiny little tweaks that I recommend, but basically, you know, you don't need me anymore unless you just want to call up and have a second opinion on something or a review periodically. And we went through the details, but boy, did that man exhale, his chest puffed up, his back straightened. He leaned back and he went, wow, I have done good, you know, and that was when they wrote out the check. I don't remember the exact fee, but, you know, low 4 digits, you know, 1,000 something was their fee. And they were really excited to write that check out. And, you know, the wife felt that same level of absolute confidence that her husband was doing great, but he didn't have it. And then he got it when I confirmed, and there were just literally 3 tweaks that I wanted him to make. And he said, yeah, that makes total sense. I'm going to make that happen. And it was a beautiful thing. And I said, well, do you think we should get back together? And with most clients, yes, that is the answer. But it may be once a year, once a quarter, whenever you need or would like a review. Younger people, it might be once every 2 or 3 years. Or if major things change in your life, you know, all of a sudden you're getting married, moving, we might want to review things. But it's more of just in time kind of financial advice, you know, immediate things coming up, instead of trying to cover everything known to a certified financial planner in one setting, which most people can't afford, nor should they ever justify paying for that kind of level of work. I can feel the arrows going in my back right now from financial advisor community. But I think a lot of times financial advice is oversold. We know certain financial products are oversold. But as a fiduciary, the first line of questioning in the fiduciary's mind has to be how they fit in the equation. Do they fit into the equation? Are they the right provider, or should they be recommended elsewhere? That's what a fiduciary should be doing.
Cheryl, shifting back to the consumer perspective, let's talk about what people should look for in an advisor. So I think you would say fiduciary, CFP probably, home in on the right business model, given what you have going mm-hmm. on. But beyond that, what are some questions that consumers should ask to help them find an advisor who's the right fit for them, just in terms of temperament and all the other things that they should have on their list?
Oh, Christine, you're so good. Temperament is, you know, you need to have somebody that you can talk to, somebody that you can open up to, that when they talk, that you feel like you're clicking, you're on the same wavelength. I had a discussion with someone I've known for years the other day, and I found out that she was afraid. She was nervous. She said, I don't know what to ask Cheryl. And I let them know that, you know, you don't need to worry about what to ask me. You know, the advisor will ask the questions that you need to. So I find that all too often, consumers of financial advice don't ask enough questions. Oftentimes, they feel that they're interacting with a professional, and if this person's an expert, who are they to question it? A little bit of my opinion is coming from, I spent a little over 10 years working in litigation cases against financial advisors who allegedly harmed their clients. And in every single one of these, it was a situation where they really liked and trusted the advisor, but the advisor took advantage. But some of the questions, and actually we have it's a generic questionnaire. It's on our website. If folks go to GarrettPlanningNetwork.com, at the very bottom of the page in the navigation bar, there's a financial advisor interview questionnaire. And this questionnaire, it doesn't say our name on it. Well, it does in the file name, but you can rename it. But you can download this and send it to any prospective advisors that you're considering. Have them complete it and send it back to you. All they'll have is your email address. You might send them a little note saying, I'm considering advisors and I would appreciate it if you'd complete this form for me, this questionnaire, and return it to me at your earliest convenience. And know that, you know, folks are typically busy. But I ask questions, you know, some of the stereotypical ones, like giving me educational and experiential background. Sometimes those experiential issues can be extremely powerful. The areas of specialty. I don't want anybody to be an afterthought. I want to be in the thick of things. If a practitioner works with a lot of school teachers, if I'm a school teacher, that's the kind of person I'd like to work with. If they work with a lot of pre-retirees or people living in retirement, and I'm doing that, that might be a person for me. The questionnaire also asks if they're affiliated with an insurance company or broker dealer, if they're a fiduciary, and they have to respond. How are you compensated? And there is an option for fee only, but it then goes on, define method of determining fees. Because there are a lot of folks mistake that fee only is assets under management. It's not. That's just one way to be paid a fee. And something like 17% of all advisors are fee only. The rest are fee and commission, or at least have the opportunity to earn commissions through their broker-dealer or insurance relationships. Here's some other questions or points that you didn't mention, Christine, that I would add to that list. So fiduciary, CFP, a business model that fits your needs, and then things like, do you have minimums for account size or assets or annual fees paid or something? That's extremely common. Most financial advisors do have minimums. That's not necessarily a bad thing. I'm not making a judgment call. But if you're looking for, say, a one-time review and this advisor has minimums, then that probably means that that's not really a good fit. And I can't really describe much about it. So I'll just say that I've seen a lot of financial plans from people who hold themselves out as planners, not of our group, of course. This was a separate project. And they provided a written, they called it a financial plan, but only one of them that I looked at even looked somewhat close to what I think of as a financial plan or what the CFP board, the Certified Financial Planner Board of Standards, would consider a financial plan. The other ones were proposals to buy insurance or investments. So, you know, the member of the public, the consumer of financial advice, doesn't necessarily know what the product, you know, the output of our work together will look like. And so one of the questions is, you know, do you provide a written detail of the recommendations? Do you offer assistance with implementation with the plan? If so, please elaborate. Do you provide a thorough written analysis, which I just mentioned, a written agreement, basically a contract, because you want to have protection. You know, what are they going to do for you and when and for what price? Another question is, do you provide a second opinion or a one-time review? That is a huge one. That one, plus the fiduciary questionnaire, are probably the most important ones on this questionnaire. It's a two-pager. It's not a big deal. It's form fillable, so the advisor can just type right in the lines. Many of our advisors have completed this form, so if a person requested one, they might get one back really quickly, and that might seem odd. Well, it's not odd because it doesn't change with each prospective client. They've just completed the questionnaire already. What I would not look for, and this may seem very contrary to common opinion or advice or what we've seen in questionnaires, I wouldn't ask for client references. Character references, I don't have any problem with that. I think that could be good. But think about client references. Most of the questionnaires I've ever seen about how to select an advisor say, talk to three clients. Well, folks, we have regulations about the privacy of our client information. But when clients are asking about talking to a client, you know, a current client, a prospective client wants to talk to a current client to determine, you know, hey, do I want to hire this person? That makes tons of sense to me. But where it breaks down is it's kind of like a job application. If I put down references on my job application, I'd be an idiot to put down names of people who would not say something good about me. So how about talking to a property and casualty agent that the advisor uses or recommends, or a CPA that they might recommend? Fee-only financial advisors that are members of the Garrett Planning Network or NAPFA, the National Association of Personal Financial Advisors, are prohibited from receiving any fees kicked back to them from referrals. So, you know, an insurance professional that I might recommend, I get nothing out of that other than hopefully my client's needs are satisfied at a price that was reasonable and very competitive, and the insurance professional took good care of them. That's all I'm asking for. And those kind of people would have a much longer history with me and my work with clients, and they've talked to some of my clients, and they might know my reputation more so. So asking your friends or, you know, folks for a recommendation, it's a very personal thing. I would first send out this questionnaire, you know, go through, you know, all the databases that you know of, like the CFP board and NAPFA, maybe the Garrett Planning Network. Those would be three places to get a whole lot of names quickly. And often we search by who's closest to us because we might want somebody that we can meet with face to face. So we put in our zip code and we'll come up with some names. If we're willing to work remotely, we might come up with a whole lot of names. And then we start, you know, reviewing their profiles, maybe visiting their websites and narrow it down from, you know, however many you had, maybe 8 or 10 names, narrow it down to about 5, and then send out this financial advisor interview questionnaire that I mentioned. It doesn't indicate where it came from. Then the next step is I'd have a phone call with those that responded and liked the responses and have a phone call, a no obligation visit, and make sure that you can talk to them and find out what kind of questions they ask you. When they start asking you how much money you have and where is it and what's it invested in, they care more about the money than you. When they start asking about you and your family and what you're trying to accomplish and where your pain points are or what your issues are, that feels a little bit better. So everybody's going to take it differently, but that connection, the connectedness that you can have with another person, that is essential. And only then would I sit down and meet with somebody or have a virtual call or something like that.
Okay. That's a super helpful overview. I just wanted to ask about from the advisor's perspective with the hourly model. You talked about that example where someone has that one-time consultation, you're good to go, bye. Mm-hmm. The question is, from the advisor's standpoint, are they constantly in client acquisition mode and wouldn't that get tiresome or tend to attract a certain type of advisor who's more comfortable doing that sort of self-selling? Let's talk about that aspect of it.
Yeah, great point. That's what I anticipated when I first launched my hourly practice, is that I would be working with people maybe once a lot, and I would be always in the client acquisition mode. But what in reality happened is within the first 20 months of opening my doors, I had to close my doors until I hired another lead planner. We ended up with 4 CFPs on staff because my firm just kept growing. It was like a small law firm. And so if you leverage, and also it's kind of, maybe a dentist office doesn't conjure up a good memory for some folks, but it works as an illustration for me. And that is, I went to the same dentist for 25 years before I moved, and I didn't pay for services other than when I used them, but I still looked at that person as my dentist. That's how my relationship with clients works. They pay for services as they use them, but they look at me, when I was working with clients, that is, they looked at me as their financial advisor. And I think a lot of that is just how we hold ourselves out, how we design the relationship. You know, it's more like dating, or when we first find that partner. If you find somebody you think you really like, do you want to sign a contract to date them exclusively for 1 year? That's basically what most financial planners or financial advisors are asking you to do. Or worse yet, turn over your portfolio while you're at it, and trust me to take care of it. Mine is more like, we're going to take dates as often as it may be appropriate, and we can always have more or less depending on the need. And so I expected to have a whole lot of one-time engagements in very limited scope, like, you know, 1 or 2 hours. I had 2 people out of about 1,000 that I saw for less than 2 hours ever. And one of those persons I saw regularly for a half an hour. So I think it is a reasonable thought, but I don't really think that it turns out that way in reality.
There's been a fair amount written recently about how there's a glut of CFAs, chartered financial analysts. I think that it's a way of illustrating in fairly stark terms how that industry has become increasingly professionalized and crowded, and some of the opportunities have maybe been squeezed out as it's become commoditized. As somebody mm-hmm. who's watched the financial planning business sort of move up the arc of professionalism, are you seeing similar signs that many are rushing in to get, say, the CFP credential, and that it's becoming commoditized in the same way? Are we still a good ways from being at that state?
I think we're still a long way in the financial planning world. We have a huge vacuum of knowledge that needs to be filled in the personal finance space. And the CFP is a wonderful education. And there's so much more and continuing education that financial advisors go through. Because of the nature of a CFA's work, I had an illustration given to me once that seemed to make sense to me. A CFA has very, very deep knowledge about a very narrow subject, investments. So imagine 10 foot deep, 1 foot square. A certified financial planner has a very, very broad understanding of nearly all things personal finance, but it can't be as deep. So it's 10 foot square and 1 foot deep. But we do have a number of members who have come over from personal money management exclusively or institutional money management, because they wanted to work with the end users. They wanted to see the effects on the lives of the money that they were managing. A mutual fund portfolio manager and several private money managers and institutional money managers with CFAs have done just that. They've moved into financial planning. Also, CPAs have moved into financial planning because the subject matter is very broad and interesting. You know, there's never 2 days or 2 client situations the same. So it is, I think we have a huge need. And as more and more clients become aware of all of the options and opportunities that are out there, and as more business models are designed like the subscription model and the hourly as needed model, it makes services more accessible to the majority of Americans that didn't have access prior to packaging our services in that way and pricing them that way.
Well, Cheryl, you have been such a great resource for us. We really enjoyed talking to you. I think we could lob another hour's worth of questions at you, but thank you so much for your time today. We really appreciate you being here.
My pleasure. I really enjoy your program. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us on The Long View. If you liked what you heard, please subscribe to and rate The Long View from Morningstar on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can follow us on Twitter at Christine_Benz.
And at SYouth1, which is SYOUTH and the number one.
Finally, we'd love to get your feedback. If you have a comment or a guest idea, please email us at thelongview@morningstar.com. Until next time, thanks for joining us.
This recording is for informational purposes only and should not be considered investment advice. Opinions expressed are as of the date of recording. Such opinions are subject to change. The views and opinions of guests on this program are not necessarily those of Morningstar Inc. and its affiliates. Morningstar and its affiliates are not affiliated with this guest or his or her business affiliates unless otherwise stated. Morningstar does not guarantee the accuracy or the completeness of the data presented herein. Jeff Batak is an employee of Morningstar Research Services, LLC. Morningstar Research Services is a subsidiary of Morningstar Inc. and is registered with and governed by the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. Morningstar Research Services shall not be responsible for any trading decisions, damages, or other losses resulting from or related to the information, data analyses, or opinions, or their use. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results. All investments are subject to investment risk, including possible loss of principal. Individuals should seriously consider if an investment is suitable for them by referencing their own financial position, investment objectives, and risk profile before making any investment decision.